This is For the Record program number 1115. This is being recorded live with a couple of pre-recorded CD excerpts, and those will be respectively from AFA program number 16 and also from For the Record program number 686. This program is a review of some information about AIDS as a biological warfare agent. Again, this is For the Record program number 1115. This is something of a, oh, I don't know what one would call it. It is review of past information, and I have been doing a series which will be continued tomorrow, dealing with the coronavirus outbreak in China as what I have termed a bio-psyop. I think there is some very compelling information that the coronavirus is not a naturally occurring phenomenon, although China has had coronavirus outbreaks, and in fact, Chinese scientists have anticipated something, a future coronavirus occurrence, but the timing of this and the political and economic circumstances surrounding this outbreak, I think, are very compelling. Not only that Trump has conducted a trade war with China temporarily on pause, this has been compounded by economic warfare being conducted by the U.S. and the Department of Commerce on the Huawei 5G network. There has been a ban on certain kinds of high-tech or tech sales to China, and there has also been the charging by quote X unquote CIA officer and current Attorney General William Barr of four People's Liberation Army officials with allegedly conducting an Equifax hack. There has also been a State Department sanction, I guess one could say, of various Chinese media outlets as of basically foreign agents, and we'll talk some more about that tomorrow. I have heard it alleged that China has, in fact, or at least the People's Liberation Army has, in fact, charged that the coronavirus is a U.S. bio, sort of made in the U.S. It is a matter of public record that, as discussed and as documented in the description for the record programs 1111 and 1112, that in fact a coronavirus of this type was synthesized in the U.S., described in the press release by the National Institutes of Health as the largest synthetic replicating organism that had been synthesized to date, and described as a precursor of the SARS MERS, the coronavirus, and something that will replicate in human lung cells and in mice. There is not only the timing of the coronavirus outbreak, which coincided with the Chinese Lunar New Year, China's biggest holiday, also one in which which people travel a great deal. And again, this occurring not only in the middle of a very obvious anti-China destabilization effort with Steve Bannon at its epicenter, and with people associated with Steve Bannon like J. Kyle Bass betting against the Chinese economy, and also networking with people like apparent J. Kyle Bass, investment partner, Republican National Committee co-chairman, associate of both Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner, Tommy Hicks Jr. Also, Tommy Hicks Jr. is networking with various government agencies on the anti-Huawei 5G project, and also having J. Kyle Bass lecture to various government officials about the Chinese banking system. Again, J. Kyle Bass, an associate of Steve Bannon, and someone who made his fortune betting against the subprime mortgage situation in the run-up to the 2008 collapse, and someone who profited from the credit default swaps that were available. More about the economic fallout from the coronavirus and the Chinese banking system in, for the record, 11/16. But I thought that given the fact that I am in my 41st year on the air, another way of looking at it is I am now beginning my third generation on the air, I thought it might be useful to do a little bit of retrospective on the history of biological warfare in the U.S. We have, that is to say, the U.S. has engaged in biological warfare, both research and in actual application, for a long time. We actually used biological warfare weapons during the Korean War. We took in the cream of the Third Reich's biological warfare people. We did the same thing with Unit 731 and Dr. Shiro Ishii, who was the commandant of that. He may have actually been an officer. I think he was also a doctor. The cream of the Axis chemical and biological warfare research apparatuses were incorporated into the U.S. Chemical and biological warfare research capability at the end of World War II. Frequently, various civilian fronts have been employed in connection with biological warfare. Perhaps the most important of our focal points vis-a-vis biological warfare, something that has been dismissed as a, quote, conspiracy theory or a Russian disinformation effort. Take your pick. That is sort of standard operating procedure these days. There is an abundant body of information dealing with AIDS as a biological warfare weapon. We dealt with that in AFA program number 16, which we are going to excerpt. We have dealt with it in numerous For the Record shows. Ed Haslam has done some magnificent work on the SV40 virus, a monkey virus that is extremely carcinogenic and that infected the polio vaccine, and there is a body of research developed by Ed that in fact attempts at finding a cancer vaccine to neutralize the effects of the SV40 pollution of the polio virus may have led to the development of a biological warfare weapon and AIDS as well. Ed's first book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, which then morphed into Dr. Mary's Monkey, is something we have spoken about a great deal. For the Record programs number 606, 682, and 686, as well as programs 912 and 1012 have updated some of the information about AIDS. We have spoken about AIDS information in For the Record 316 as well. A number of programs, 480 and 585, have dealt with Lyme disease as well. On April 23rd of 1986, we did the AFA program number 16 about AIDS as a biological warfare weapon. I was assisted by my very charming and brilliant former co-host, Nick Tuck, and we downloaded or we accessed in that program an interview that was conducted in December of 1984 on KPFA, the Pacifica station in Berkeley. Raina Cowan was interviewed Dr. Wilbert Jordan from Martin Luther King Hospital in Los Angeles. Here is that interview from December of 1984 as we accessed it in April of 1986, dealing with some of the epidemiological aspects of AIDS.
One of the growing crises in the United States today is AIDS. And with me on the phone right now, I have a person who's an expert in many different aspects of AIDS. He's the director of graduate medical education at Martin Luther King Hospital in Los Angeles. And he's an ex-public health chief for the southern area of L.A. County. He's had training in infectious diseases, and I want to welcome Dr. Wilbert Jordan to the airways. Good afternoon, doctor.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, I had heard about you originally from a friend of mine who was in UCLA Medical School who studied with you, and you had done a lot of research on infectious diseases. And right now, with more and more information coming out about infectious diseases, where they come from, how they start, and I'm especially interested in AIDS, I thought I wanted to get the information of somebody who's an expert in epidemiology. Why don't you begin telling me exactly what epidemiologists study and how this relates to learning about AIDS?
Well, epidemiology really is the study of disease and disease trends in terms of trying to determine where the disease comes from, how long it takes it to go through a complete cycle, its virulence, how potent it can be, etc. So an epidemiologist really studies the effects, the causes and effects of a disease. He or she doesn't necessarily treat the disease. Some are also medically trained, as I am. Many have masters in public health or doctors in public health and may not be necessarily physicians. But they study disease trends, disease outbreaks, and not treat the individual. So they look at the overall disease in a cluster rather than individual cases.
Well, I can't really say what kind of diseases have you studied, but your expertise, what has it proved about certain diseases, especially in the past few years, diseases like AIDS or the Legionnaire's disease are considered new diseases, like we've never experienced them before.
Right.
What does that actually mean? How can a disease really come out of nowhere?
Well, it isn't that it comes out of nowhere. We have to ask where did it come from. We see swine flu develop. We have the flu vaccine every year, and it changes all the time. Influenza is a changing virus, which is why we give it names like Hong Kong, Brazil, Tokyo, Influenza A Tokyo, because a new strain is found in that area, and we always name it for that. So that's nothing new. We had diseases that are developing all the time. Some of the things that's interesting about AIDS, though, is to me, is the lack of attention as to where it has come from. We tend to keep looking outside of the United States shores, and I personally, and I'm sure that's my friend, or your friend may have told you, have questioned some of the present theories as to where AIDS comes from, just using common sense. And one doesn't have to be an epidemiologist, just look at what we see and ask some questions. This is a disease, it has a high morbidity, it is deadly. It is the most impressive and most critical crisis we've had in public health in any of our generations, whether you're 70 or whether you're 7. This is worse than polio. And even smallpox, I would dare say, was not as critical as this is right now. But I don't think we're really looking at some of the very simple questions in terms of where did this come from, and that's where I think I have disagreed with some other people.
When you mention where it comes from, I have heard stories that it comes from rabbits from southern Japan. I've heard it comes from monkeys from Haiti. I've heard that it started in Haiti or Zaire. Or there's many theories about where it started.
That's, you know, it's interesting about the American personality when we think of ourselves as being better than everybody else. So whenever something bad happens, we always say, where did it come from, assuming it couldn't have come from here. I think the Haitian theory was really ridiculous. This is a disease that is basically affecting Americans. Over 85% of all cases in the world still, and we're now in the 6th year of this disease, are in America. It is an American disease. Most of the cases in Europe or outside of this country, you can trace back to having had contact with someone in this country. The only atypical ones are the ones in France that one can trace back to Zaire, which has been different. But for the most part, the European cases were traced back to the United States. So you have a disease that is affecting a reasonably large number of people with a very high mortality rate. At this point, those who even live to get out of the hospital the first time have a life expectancy of about 2 years. The overwhelming majority in the United States, 3 metropolitan areas particularly, New York, San Francisco, and L.A., that's unusual. Viruses, bacteria, don't do that. Diseases don't create themselves or don't become born in one country, get on a plane or a boat, go to a second country, become epidemic for 2 or 3 years, and then be found retrospectively in the first country. And I said it because this is what was said about Haiti. The first 500 cases that we knew about were in this country. There were no cases in Haiti. And those persons who had it hadn't been to Haiti, hadn't been around any Haitians. San Francisco is epidemic right now. You don't have many Haitians there. And in fact, I think if you have any cases, then it's no more than 1 or 2 in persons who are Haitian. So it's not like you have cases. In fact, in American cities that have large number of Haitians, i.e. Washington, D.C., Boston, Philadelphia, you don't have many cases of AIDS. Miami is a port that has them, and so does New York. But your other major cities that have large Haitian populations don't have large cases of AIDS.
So where do you think AIDS does come from?
I think we have to look at our own 48 states and ask where does it come from. And I say that because if you look at Haiti again, and you can say, well, let's look at Haiti. If we accept that theory, that means either someone from here went there and got it and brought it back, or someone from there brought it to this country, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you said someone from here went there, the first case were in white homosexual male majority, then I would have to ask, one, why only white homosexual males from New York, San Francisco, and L.A.? Frankly, those white homosexual males who travel to Haiti for a adventurous trip don't tend to get involved with a dirty-looking native boy, to sound very whatever, but tend to meet other people coming also from other country. Secondly, a large number of white homo and heterosexuals from Europe also go to Haiti. So if it was from someone going to Haiti from this country, then one, why the predominance in those 3 cities? And two, why didn't we see it also in Europe, since you have whites from Europe also going to Haiti? Homosexual males from New York, San Francisco, and L.A. It's a very, very particular virus. I don't buy that. If you tell me it's someone from Haiti brought it over here, I say, one, it's interesting. We never heard of it being in Haitians until we had the Haitians put in concentration camps in Florida, and then suddenly we were able to backtrack and find it in Haiti. Two, the average Haitian and the above or below average Haitian who come to the United States move into a black Haitian community, which intermingles more with the routine black community, which has some association with the white community, and will finally find its way to the white gay community. Haitians do not have a strong association with white male homosexuals. So again, if it was brought to here by a Haitian, how does he get from the boat to the white gay male community in L.A., San Francisco, and New York without and bypassing the Haitian community and the black community, particularly in L.A., where there is, we've had no cases. That makes no sense. You have a disease that is predominantly in Americans. The other cities, Chicago, New York, Chicago, Washington, Philadelphia, Baltimore, New Orleans, with very large gay populations, larger in number than San Francisco, but are not at all afflicted with the number of cases. So it is not just numbers of homosexuals. It is not just promiscuity. What is unique about those 3 cities is the fact they have a very structured gay community, more than any other city. And I think that's interesting. I think we need to be asking, is there an association with that fact, that the three cities that we have rampant cases, a really high number of cases and rate, are the three cities that have, if you could rate it, a more structured gay community. Washington, D.C. has a very, very large gay community, but it's a very, very integrated gay community. So is Chicago, and so is New Orleans. But those three cities have very identifiable gay communities. Is that by accident? Is that also coincidental? I mean, there's too many coincidences here for me to accept. And to me, it points to this being a disease that is an American disease. Now, where it came from, one can speculate and go from one extreme to the other, but I personally think it is something that was created in some kind of laboratory here.
I think it's interesting that researchers are spending a lot of time trying to figure out where it came from, what other country, and not that much money is being spent on research. Some people are speculating on the idea that that why is it certain gay populations, I mean, you just mentioned that it's three urban centers that seem to be the ones that are getting it, and the news media is playing up the fact of lifestyle, but there's a lot of the other reasons. When you mentioned earlier the unification of these particular gay communities, how do you think that that could be used in some way, both to fight the disease and for somehow the disease to be brought in?
Well, I think, and I hope I can speak freely without offending someone, without trying to catch my word and maybe not be totally understood. I think what is unique about white homosexual males, and I will separate them from black homosexuals particularly, is that they have tried to proclaim themselves as an ethnic group. You have now a new ethnic group with no international ties. It is an American ethnic group. You really can't say it about black homosexuals, because black homosexuals have been in the closet to come out of. They've been out of the closet. You can go to any black church in any major city and you will find people who everyone knows is gay, who's functioning, who has a very established, responsible role in churches and other organizations too. This is, again, to me, a white male homosexual phenomenon. And the best way I can explain it is to give an example. If I were to have, or you were to give me a virus that had an effect on skin color, and we say this virus will make black people sterile, but it may turn white people green. We need to test it to see if we've seen it in rats, we've seen it in monkeys. Let's see if it would do what we think it would do in black people. Well, I know there are certain places I can go in the black community where the people, basically, total association, total lifestyle of black people. I wouldn't go to Second Baptist Church here in L.A. I wouldn't go to Concord Baptist Church in New York. I don't know any of the names of the major churches in San Francisco, but my point, I wouldn't go to a place that had a very middle-class type of black audience, because those people would have contact the next day with whites, so you would have an overflow into the white community right away. I do know where there are clubs. I do know where there are storefront churches. I do know where there are places I go to in the black community, where the people, first, second, third, and go probably four generations, their contacts are all black. I don't know that about the gay community. I think you have that same counterpart, though, in New York, San Francisco, and L.A. You don't have it as much in Washington, Chicago, and other cities, but you have the numbers. So somebody else may know what places they can go that you could do the same thing. And I think it's interesting that in some of the early cases of the disease, you had a lot of interesting stories, and particularly the one in San Francisco where there were nine people, all had been at one bar and a table. One physician in San Francisco knew 20 of the first 45 cases. That's atypical. There's no one physician in any city, even if he can proclaim himself to be a gay doctor or just serve in the gay community, would know that just by accident. That's strange. There have been too many sort of strange things happen with this disease. And one still can't account for the fact that now, in 1984, we're going into 85, this disease started in 79, you still are seeing the same percentages stay in the same three cities. No other disease does that. Hepatitis didn't do that. And the Bassett didn't do that. San Francisco is probably the gay capital of the U.S. in terms of somebody in Des Moines, Iowa, Little Rock, fantasizing where to go. and then go to San Francisco or New York or L.A., still, in a lot of those cases that you've had in those cities have been people who've come to San Francisco or who went to Los Angeles or New York and got infected and came back. But you haven't had it set up that much there and started spreading. That's interesting. You don't have in many cities with reasonable and sizable gay communities an ongoing epidemic like you have in San Francisco, which is now really out of hand.
That's interesting, because I think the doctors around here are talking about AIDS as being a social phenomenon versus a disease phenomena. When you talk about...
Well, you know, when you say social, the only thing you can... Homosexuals today are not doing anything they weren't doing in the times of Rome. The human body hasn't changed. There is still the same anatomy. Nothing is new. There are maybe one or two new... The most new things are basically the cosmetics one uses is new. That's not... been before, but certainly the sex acts aren't new. Men do one particular sex act that is strictly a male act that you don't find women and women doing or men and women doing, and from my reading, I haven't heard of it being that long. So I don't, that's the only, if I would say, new sex act that involves using the fist, but other than that, certainly sex acts per se is nothing new. We've been doing it all along, so it can't just be the sex act. It can be promiscuity. You've had promiscuous heterosexuals, homosexuals for years. That's nothing new. In San Francisco and in Little Rock and in Oklahoma City, you've had promiscuity for years in terms of one individual being promiscuous, in terms of a lot of individuals being promiscuous. Gay bathhouses are not new. You've had them for years. At least 20 years, you've had bathhouses. So that's nothing new. So if you're going to say this disease, I've had 56 cases, most of whom, in terms of their sexual contact, you really can plot it being 2 to 6 months. I differ with some saying this before you. I don't believe that most of the patients I've had, their contact, you could really tell, was relatively 2 to 4 months incubation period. Yet that is the case. This is something new. Now, when in Lassa fever, if you remember, in 72, 73, became known in Africa, before the first case got out, we knew about it. A quarantine station in all of our major ports were on alert. You checked everyone. Smallpox, if someone got a fever on a plane from any country that had smallpox, you knew about it. We knew how many cases of smallpox were in the deepest part of Ethiopia, Somalia, and in India. We've known about it all the time. Marburg virus, we knew, we caught it. Now, I'm expected to believe that this virus, which is so much deadlier, which might not wipes you out, an American who is among the healthiest persons in this world, I'm now expected to believe it has been in existence in Haiti, which is the poorest country in this hemisphere, where the average person is malnourished already, where the average person's immune system is already compromised. If AIDS began in Haiti, Haiti wouldn't have any people. And if AIDS began in Haiti, why don't we see it on the Dominican Republic, which is the same island? It's just, no, it's a mountain that separates two countries. It makes no sense.
We're speaking with Dr. Wilbur Jordan, and he's the director of graduate medical education at Martin Luther King Hospital in L.A., and he's the ex-public health chief for the southern area of L.A. County. He's had training in infectious diseases. We're almost running out of time, Dr. Jordan, and it seems to me that you're building up to say something. I mean, from what you're saying, it seems to me that there's some type of testing going on. Maybe I'm at liberty to say that, but... What do you think, actually, why are these certain populations getting it? And I wish we had more time to talk, and in the future we can do a longer interview.
Well, I don't think I want to say why. I think we need to ask ourselves why, and look at it. Pick up any book and look at any other disease, and you would see that it is extremely difficult for any other disease, hepatitis B, which we theorize being transmitted the same way, has not stayed strictly in the gay male community in three cities. All I am really suggesting is that we start asking ourselves, one, why do we continue to look outside of these shores for the cause of it, or for the origin of this disease, and why does it tend to stay in three metropolitan areas when there are many other cities in this country that have very large gay populations, this is not the first time we've had some kind of, quote, germ warfare. I mean, San Francisco subways were sprayed with serratia bacteria, as you know. We did treat black soldiers with syphilis and didn't treat them. We did give black soldiers syphilis and didn't treat them. There have been other kinds of experiments. And whether this is one of them, I don't know. But I think one has to look at something from these shores, or at least entertain that idea to see if, in fact, it is not that, rather than trying to assume it comes from an underdeveloped country where, if you've seen patients with the disease, you see it's devastating. If this disease began in any underdeveloped country, there is no way in this world it could have began there and us not know about it before it got here. I mean, it's this of all diseases, this. We even knew about super gonorrhea in the Philippines, and it did not kill anyone. How in the world could you have a disease like this that has, at this point, a 50% mortality in 2 years, and hopefully, unless we can find some treatment, those other persons who have the disease have a 2-year life expectancy. This is the most deadly disease we've had created that we've known about in our lifetime. How could you possibly have had it in an underdeveloped country where the average person is malnourished, already susceptible, and not see any cases until you've had over 500 in the United States, and then you go back retroactively and find it in Zaire? That makes no sense.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time.
That, again, from AFA program number 16 from April of 1986. The interview was conducted in December of 1984. Of course, there have been drugs that have been developed to treat AIDS in the interim. I would note that there, as we have noted in past programs, black people have a particular susceptibility HIV. It afforded protection to infection by malaria, but makes them more susceptible to the HIV. On the other hand, purebred Northern Europeans, quote, Aryans, unquote, are the only people who have a hereditary immunity from infection by HIV. That is the CCR5 Delta 32 allele. We've talked about that. And for the record, 606, 912, and 1012, and an AFA 39 as well. I would note that that gene also afforded immunity to the Black Death. Bubonic plague was researched by the Third Reich as a biological warfare weapon. The doctor in charge of that was Dr. Kurt Blohm, B-L-O-M-E. He reported directly to Heinrich Himmler. Their biological warfare research program was disguised as a cancer research program, and Dr. Blohm went to work for the U.S. after World War II. And very quickly, from the book A Higher Form of Killing, we have accessed this in many programs by Jeremy Paxman and Robert Harris. As long ago as 1962, 40 scientists were employed at the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Laboratories on full-time genetics research. Many others, it was said, appreciate the implications of genetics for their own work, unquote. The implications were made more specific that genetic engineering could solve one of the major disadvantages of biological warfare, that it is limited to diseases which occur naturally somewhere in the world. Quote, within the next, this was in 1969 for the House Appropriations Subcommittee hearings on the appropriations for defense for fiscal year 69. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutical processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. That from Dr. MacArthur in the House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing in 1969. The authors go on to add, the possibility that such a super germ may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside. We're now going to excerpt for the record 686. The focal point of AIDS research in this country early on was the National Cancer Institute's Special Viral Cancer Research Program that was at Fort Detrick, and it was what was turned over to civilians. There was a subsidiary of Litton Industries, Litton Biomedics, that basically handled that. It handled the Fort Detrick Special Viral, the National Cancer Institute's Special Viral Cancer Research Program. There was an article in 1992 in Covert Action Information Bulletin that I read into the record in For the Record 686. Here it is.
This article is called The Cancer National Cancer Institute and Fort Detrick Link. It was authored by Richard Hatch. It was published by Covert Action Information Bulletin in their issue number 39, the winter of 1991 and 92. I have read a small amount of this into a supplement to AFA program number 16. The article begins with a quote from Colonel William D. Taggart, former commander of the Army's medical unit at Fort Detrick. He said, "Those who would increase the potency of biological weapons must search for improved methods of mass production of organisms, factors which will enhance the virulence, ways to prolong the storage life of living agents, ways to improve aerosol stability, and methods of producing variant organisms by recombination or by other means." And then Richard Hatch goes on to write, "In 1969, President Richard Nixon ordered a halt to offensive biological warfare research and weapons stockpiling by the United States. The U.S. Army destroyed its toxins, viruses, and bacteria with heat and disinfectants by May of 1972. The disposal of the scientific personnel was not so simple. Some of these bio-warriors went to the CIA. Others quickly found new support from the National Cancer Institute, particularly in its Virus Cancer Program, or VCP. Parenthetically, it was this program and Fort Detrick, renamed the Frederick Research Center, that was the epicenter of AIDS research, and it is because of that that I am reading this article into the record, and again, sort of shouting it from the rooftop, so to speak. Continuing, the National Cancer Institute funded and supervise some of the same scientists, universities, and contracting corporations, ostensibly for cancer research, which had conducted biological warfare research. Some of these medical research contracts ran simultaneously with the U.S. Biological Warfare Program. When the military work ended, the civilian programs continued to expand on the same critical areas outlined by Colonel Tigert, or Tigert, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, T-I-G-E-R-T-T. The NCI's viral cancer program, a highly politicized public relations effort, was launched in 1971 with great fanfare as part of Nixon's war on cancer. The stated aim of the program was to organize experiments aimed at finding cancer-causing viruses. Apparently, this agenda was compatible with the incorporation into various units of the VCP of possibly dozens of former USBW researchers who continue to study topics with potential military application. Potential cancer-causing viruses were collected, grown in huge amounts, and distributed through the thousands of animals that were infected experimentally, and the aerosol distribution of carcinogenic viruses was also studied. Two former biological warfare facilities would play a large part in the viral cancer program. The U.S. Army's Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland had been the, quote, parent research and pilot plant center for biological warfare, unquote. During the early 1960s, the CIA paid the facility $100,000 a year for biological warfare and chemical agents and their delivery systems. In Oakland, California, the Naval Biosciences Laboratory was involved in early experiments with the plague and collaborated in massive, open-air tests of biological warfare simulants in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1950s. Former biological warfare specialists from both of these centers were deeply involved in all aspects of the viral cancer program. So again, note, that in addition to Fort Detrick, also the Naval Biosciences Laboratory, right here in our backyard in Oakland, California, figure prominently in this concatenation, the viral cancer program of the National Cancer Institute. Note also that the CCR5 Delta 32 genetic variant, which provides purebred Northern Europeans, or quote, Aryans, unquote, with a hereditary immunity to HIV infection, was discovered because it also apparently provided immunity to some of those same people from infection by bubonic plague. New thinking, by the way, on the Black Death of Europe is that it was not actually bubonic plague, or what we call bubonic plague, but actually a viral hemorrhagic fever that was introduced from Africa by some of the early trade and exploration that was taking place in that time, possibly by some of the Crusaders as well. Now, what we're going to look at here, in addition to further developing the link between the National Cancer Institute's viral cancer program and biological warfare research, is the relationship between key universities, in this case the University of California, and those programs. Richard Hatch's next section here is called The University Military Complex, and it reads, "Reflecting a common pattern of cooperation, much of the military-related research took place at institutions connected with or directly part of U.S. universities. The University of California is well known for its role in managing the two main U.S. nuclear weapons laboratories, the Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. Less well known is the fact that UC Berkeley also helps manage the Naval Biosciences Laboratory, or NBL, earlier called the Naval Biological Laboratory. This connection became central to the VCP and continued after the ban on offensive biological warfare work. Well before President Nixon ordered the conversion of the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Center at Fort Detrick to civilian uses in 1971, this military facility was cooperating closely with the University of California. From 1953 to 1968, the University of California, while managing the Naval Biosciences Laboratory, now at the Naval Supply Center, also had biological warfare contracts with the United States Army. After U.S. treaty obligations would have prevented open research on mass production of dangerous viruses without a medical cover, the VCP provided an ideal excuse to study scale-up problems. One of the first new priorities at the Fort Detrick facility after the ban was, quote, the large-scale production of oncogenic or cancer-causing and suspected oncogenic viruses, unquote. Within a year, the NCI began mass production, and within one 15-month period ending in June of 1977, the viral cancer program produced 60,000 liters of cancer-causing and immunosuppressive viruses. That, by the way, that's quite a figure, 60,000 liters. That is a lot of microorganisms, deadly microorganisms under the circumstances. Continuing, throughout the 1970s, U.S. defensive, unquote, biological warfare efforts were increasingly aimed at the research and development of viral disease agents. The seed stocks for this massive production of viruses came from the Cell Culture Laboratory, or CCL. The CCL was, quote, physically located at the Naval Biosciences Laboratory, or NBL, in Oakland, California. Because this laboratory was financed in part by the NCI and linked to UC, it would become a clearinghouse and central repository for vast quantities of potentially cancer-causing tissues and the tissues that might contain them. Thus, after the ban, the Naval Biosciences Lab at UC continued experimentation on biological agents, but under the guise of defensive, unquote, research. The viral cancer program contract ran concurrently with the Naval Biosciences Laboratory's work on bubonic plague, Rift Valley fever, and meningitis. The NBL did other research for Fort Detrick as well, before the 1972 ban on offensive work. The National Biosciences Laboratory also performed much of the original research into biological warfare done during World War II. At some, NBL work was, quote, listed only in Pentagon research bulletins, unquote. The Naval Biosciences Laboratory Cell Culture Laboratory project was supervised for the viral cancer program of the National Cancer Institute by Drs. James Duff and Jack Gruber. Duff had been at Fort Detrick for 12 years, joining the NCI. His biography lists research into Clostridium botulinum toxins and 13 botulinum toxins known to cause botulism, food poisoning, and they are among the most toxic substances known. It was during Duff's tenure at Fort Detrick that the U.S. Army stockpiled botulinum toxin weapons. There, too, the intensive study of psittacosis or parrot fever resulted in the accidental infection of at least 12 workers while Duff was working there. After serving for 8 years at Fort Detrick, Gruber moved to the National Cancer Institute. His biography lists work on arthropod-borne viruses, unquote. The U.S. stockpiled biological warfare weapons based on one arthropod-borne virus and studied many others. He soon became chair of the Program Resources and Logistics Advisory Group of the Viral Cancer Program, where he helped coordinate projects involving production of viruses, provision of test animals, and the Biohazard Safety Program, unquote. In 1984, Gruber became head of the Cancer Etiology Division of the National Institutes of Health. And in addition to the relationship here between biological warfare research veterans Dr. James Duff and Jack Gruber and the viral cancer research program of the National Cancer Institute's Cell Culture Laboratory, which was maintained at the Naval Biosciences Laboratory, there was also tremendous research into aerosol-borne viruses and other agents. In the next section of Richard Hatch's article, it's in the air. The field of aerobiology, or the transmission of disease organisms through the air, is essentially an outgrowth of biological warfare research. The military objective of exposing many people to a biological warfare agent and the ready susceptibility to infection by inhaling these agents make aerosol weapons the most practical form of transmission. The National Cancer Institute also studied aerosol transmission of viruses intensively. One such study, FS-57, Aerosol Properties of Oncogenic Viruses, was funded at more than $100,000 a year. After the ban on offensive BW research, the NCI and the Office of Naval Research jointly sponsored NBL experiments on the, quote, aerosol properties of potentially oncogenic viruses. The National Cancer Institute justified its aerosol research because its scientists often handled suspect cancer viruses in a highly concentrated form. A lab accident could release a mist of virus. National Cancer Institute needed to understand and anticipate the danger. How the Navy justified its interest is unknown, but if a new cancer-causing biological warfare agent was discovered, it would likely be delivered as an aerosol. The line between aerosol and biological warfare research was often a fine one. The National Cancer Institute's project officer and former U.S. Air Force virologist Dr. Alfred Hellman worked with Mark Chatigny, a research engineer at Naval Biosciences Laboratory and also a member of the National Cancer Institute's Biohazards Work Group from the NBL. Biological warfare research veteran Dr. Hellman also oversaw the 1971 $100,000 Naval Biosciences Laboratory study on the, quote, physical and biological characteristics of viral aerosols, unquote. In 1961, the Naval Biosciences Laboratory had done similar research for Fort Detrick on the, quote, stability and virulence of biological warfare aerosols, unquote. Dr. Chatigny's Naval Biosciences Lab research into aerosol distribution of viruses would continue well into the 1980s. Such overlapping of purposes raises serious questions about the wisdom of placing control of viral cancer program viruses under the NBL. More about aerosol studies here. And Richard Hatch's next section is called, appropriately, More Aerosol Studies. While UC Berkeley appears to have been at the heart of aerosol BW research, it was by no means alone. Other universities collaborated with the BW effort while working on the VCP in parallel. From 1955 to 1965, the Ohio State University College of Medicine conducted research for Fort Detrick into the aerosol transmission of BW agents, including tularemia and Q fever. In some of these studies, prisoners from the Ohio State Penitentiary were used as guinea pigs. Between 1952 and 1969, the affiliated Ohio State University Research Foundation had 8 contracts with the U.S. Army for biological warfare research. tularemia, rabbit fever, and Q fever were ultimately stockpiled by the U.S. Army. Before he worked with University of California, Dr. Hellman supervised an NCI contract for Ohio State University. Designed to study the aerosol transmission of cancer-causing viruses, this research started in 1965 and continued at least until 1972. The principal investigator for this work, Dr. Richard Grismer, would eventually succeed in giving tumors to mice and monkeys. Grismer then went to work briefly at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, part of the U.S. Department of Energy Nuclear Research System. After his stint at Oak Ridge, Grismer returned to NCI, where he headed the NCI Bioassay Program, which tested chemicals suspected of causing cancer. This multi-million dollar program was so badly managed that epidemics forced the killing of nearly 90,000 test animals, and testing of suspected carcinogenic chemicals fell far behind schedule. Many other universities prominent in the USBW program, such as Johns Hopkins, University of Maryland, and the University of Minnesota, were also heavily involved in the VCP. Since the BW work performed by these universities remains classified, the exact relationship between VCP and biological warfare research remains a murky one. The pattern of overlapping military BW and NCI work was paralleled by the relationship between industrial contractors and the viral cancer program of the NCI. Charles Pfizer and Company, Incorporated, a pharmaceutical firm, had a contract with the NCI which included production of, quote, a large quantity of a variety of viruses for the VCP. The immunosuppressive Mason-Pfizer monkey virus was grown in large quantity, and other animal cancer viruses were adapted to grow in human cell lines. During the same time period, 1961 to 1971, the NCI contractor, Pfizer, conducted a secret study for the U.S. Army, quote, into the growth and culture media for unspecified biological agents, unquote. In addition, from 1968 to 1970, Pfizer had a contract for scale production and evaluation of staphylococcal enterotoxoid B, unquote, for the U.S. Army BW program. Staphylococcal enterotoxoid is a protective vaccine against a bacterial toxin which was part of the U.S. arsenal. The production of vaccine against a stockpiled BW weapon must be considered an offensive BW project. According to MIT scientists Harley Strauss and Jonathan King, quote, these steps, the generation of a potential BW agent, development of a vaccine against it, testing of the efficacy of the vaccine, are all components that would be associated with an offensive BW program. Clearly, without an antidote or vaccine to protect attacking troops, the utility of a stockpiled BW agent would be seriously limited. Next comes a really important section of the article. President Nixon's 1971 announcement that Fort Detrick would be converted to a center for cancer research could not be immediately implemented. First, biological warfare agents stored there, such as the anti-crop agent rice blast, had to be destroyed. The buildings were then decontaminated and the facilities were turned over to the National Cancer Institute, which renamed the facility Frederick Cancer Research Center. Litton Bionetics was named as the prime contractor. A major player in the military-industrial complex, Litton Bionetics Corporation worked extensively on the dispersion of biological warfare agents from planes and included U.S. Air Force contracts for the, quote, supersonic delivery of dry biological agents, unquote. From 1966 to 1968, Bionetics Research Laboratories, which became Litton Bionetics in 1973, held two contracts with the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Program. At the same time, it held major contracts with the National Cancer Institute. One of Bionetics Research Laboratories' most important NCI contracts was a massive virus inoculation program that began in 1962 and ran until at least 1976 and used more than 2,000 monkeys. Dr. Robert Gallo, the controversial head of the current U.S. AIDS research program at National Cancer Institute and the chief of its tumor cell biology laboratory, and the aforementioned Dr. Jack Gruber, formerly of VCP and then NIH, were project officers for the inoculation program. The monkeys were injected with everything from human cancer tissues to rare viruses and even sheep's blood in an effort to find a transmissible cancer. Many of these monkeys succumb to immunosuppression after infection with the Mason-Pfizer monkey virus, the first known immunosuppressive retrovirus, a class of viruses that includes the HIV or human immunodeficiency virus. In 1976, Dr. Seymour Coulter, a prominent NCI scientist and former military medicine expert, reported on experiments so dangerous that other scientists publicly asked for an end to such work. By blending the genetic material of viruses causing cancers in mice and baboons, he created a new virus which could cause cancer in dogs, monkeys, and even chimpanzees. Because it could attack chimpanzees, other scientists feared it could spread to genetically similar human beings. The new virus was a product of some of the first crude genetic recombination experiments. Lawrence Loeb and Kenneth Tartoff of the Institute for Cancer Research in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, went even further in calling for change and calling for a ban on such potentially dangerous experimentation. The production of malignant tumors in a variety of primate species suggests the possibility of creating viruses that are oncogenic for humans. Therefore, we urge that all experiments involving co-cultivation of known oncogenic viruses with primate viruses be immediately halted until the safety of such experiments are extensively evaluated, unquote. Experiments performed under NCI contract, including many dangerous viral inoculation programs like the primate inoculation program run by Gallo and Gruber. So-called species barriers were routinely breached in efforts to find or create infectious cancer viruses. Viruses native to one species were injected into animals from another species in hope of triggering cancers. Often, the recipient animal would be immunosuppressed by radiation, drugs, or other treatment. NIH primate researchers were well aware that, quote, the ecological niches of man and animal cross with increasing frequency, and this undoubtedly will create or uncover new problems, unquote. At a 1975 NCI symposium, a participant, Dr. J. Moore Janowski, admitted that, quote, environmental motivated groups begin to consider primate laboratories as being a source of danger, unquote. He continued to comment that, quote, a European primate center was not able to begin operations as a result of adverse publicity they obtained because of the Marburg disease outbreak. The speaker was referring to a 1967 outbreak in Yugoslavia and West Germany of this viral disease, which killed several people. Tissues obtained from the African green monkeys used in biomedical work were the source of the mini-epidemic. Dr. Moore Janowski suggested that researchers should fight against tighter restrictions on primate experiments. Upon the National Cancer Institute aegis, VCP provided many opportunities for contact between former BW specialists and others in the scientific community. Former BW specialists Dr. Peter Garone and Arnold Weedham were prominent members of the Biohazard Control and Containment segment of the VCP. Their positions allowed them frequent contact with laboratories handling hazardous viruses. Garone and Weedham both worked for many years at Fort Detrick. They were both specialists in the airborne transmission of diseases. In the 1950s, Weedham was in charge of U.S. Army tests of tularemia or rabbit fever on human volunteers. In Garone's BW research, he used prisoners from the federal prison camp at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. This group of human guinea pigs was more fortunate than Dr. Weedham's. They were exposed only to cold viruses. Garone was awarded the Army's Meritorious Civilian Service Award for his efforts at Fort Detrick. The 1975 NCI-sponsored symposium on biohazards and zoonotic problems of primate procurement, quarantine, and research illustrates another aspect of NCI military cooperation. Zoonoses, diseases that can be transmitted from animals to humans, make up the majority of biological warfare agents. The meeting brought together NCI researchers, 9 military officers from major to colonel, and a civilian from the Edgewood Arsenal, a U.S. chemical warfare facility also in Maryland. The officers were from the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, the Defense Nuclear Agency, and the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. In addition, Drs. Weedham, Duff, Gruber, and Garone were all in attendance, and by the way, all biological warfare research veterans. Giron presented a paper on the biohazards of experimentally infected primates. He now headed Tulane University's Delta Regional Primate Research Center. In passing, he mentioned aerosol hazards and recommended, quote, exposing animals so that only the head is in contact with the aerosol rather than whole body exposure, unquote. Weedham had previously briefed him on BW tests involving just such exposure of monkeys to aerosolized staphylococcal enterotoxin. In these tests, four Fort Detrick workers still became ill through exposure to the animals. Presumably, Giron was also aware of a 1964 accident when 15 Fort Detrick workers inhaled aerosol staphylococcal enterotoxin B, milligram for milligram, one of the most deadly agents ever studied, unquote. Skipping down. Research into viruses during the war on cancer provided an ideal cover for continuing biological warfare research. As Colonel Tiggert advised, the NCI project allowed the mass production of viruses, the development of means to enhance virulence, exploration of aerosol transmission, and the production of new recombinant disease agents. These civilian projects ran concurrently with military projects in many cases. When political expediency dictated an end to overt U.S. biological warfare research, the viral cancer program provided a means to continue experiments that would otherwise be difficult to justify.
That again from For the Record 686, and that was that project was the focal point of early AIDS research in this country. In the written description for the program, there will be links to some of the other broadcasts dealing with this subject. This concludes For the Record program number 1115, review of information about AIDS as a biological warfare weapon, being recorded live on February 20th of 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.